Good morning. I have no disclosures either. The objectives of this portion of the session will revolve around discussing some of the influences of social factors on neonatal outcomes following preterm birth, some review of the spectrum of both health and developmental issues that affect preterm children, as well as some comments related to some of the social determinants of neonatal outcome. Just briefly to review, when we talk about preterm birth, it actually covers a wide swath of pregnancy from as early as 22 weeks all the way through 36 weeks completed gestation. Within the category of preterm birth, we have babies who are considered moderately preterm, those born between 32 and 36 weeks of gestation, and within that subset of babies, there is an even smaller group called the late preterm infant between 34 and 36 weeks of gestation, who in fact make up the largest percentage of preterm infants. We also have two other categories, the very preterm baby, born between 28 and 31 weeks of gestation, and those infants born less than 27 weeks gestation, the extremely preterm. Each of them have their own risks, as well in terms of both their acute care needs, as well as their ultimate impact on their both health and developmental outcomes, impacts on family and community. When we talk about risk factors for preterm birth, some of this has been shared before by the other discussants. Clearly issues related to race and ethnicity, as well as stressful life events, family history in terms of histories of prior preterm births in family members. Although there are not specific genetic factors that have been identified and replicated throughout multiple studies, there is evidence that there is a heritable component in terms of the risk for preterm birth, as well as information related to infections, maternal characteristics. We know that at the extremes of childbearing, both in terms of teen mothers, as well as mothers with what's referred to as advanced maternal age, which really means women over 35 years of age, and issues related to parity. So the teen mother who's a multi-para, the older woman who has delayed childbearing, and both are at risk for preterm delivery. Prior reproductive history, both in terms of terminations of pregnancy, and as we all know, the highest risk for, or the most important risk factor for preterm birth is having had a prior preterm infant. Multiple gestations. With each additional baby, the gestation is shortened by 2 to 3 weeks. Socioeconomic factors, some of which have been presented, and I'll spend a little more time reviewing that as well. Issues related to tobacco usage, alcohol, and drugs during pregnancy and prior to pregnancy increase one's risk for preterm birth, as well as environmental factors. This schematic actually pulls together some of what was presented by both Dr. Williams as well as Dr. Holzman in terms of crafting a framework for understanding the association of race and preterm birth with integration of those institutionalized factors, social environment, social support, socioeconomic status, the phenotypic race, and pulling together those factors related to the underlying biology in terms of genotype and epigenetics, preconceptional health. We know that among women at risk, there are much higher rates of metabolic condition, diabetes, hypertension, and much of this actually is now being related back to the birth histories of many of these women themselves. Many of these women were themselves small for gestational age, were low birth weight, so that there is a progressive intergenerational or multi-generational effect that even with improvements in socioeconomic status, improvements in education, don't fully mitigate the underlying risk factor. And clearly, as was discussed by Dr. Holzman, issues related to acute and chronic and early life stress. The interplay of those factors with substance abuse, the vascular dysfunction, abnormalities in terms of the thalamic pituitary axis dysfunction and inflammation, all contributing to preterm birth. This is another way of looking at the relationships between risk factors and the biologic mechanisms of preterm birth, where one can see that for the various risk factors, the interplay of genetics, inflammation, neuroendocrine abnormalities, vascular abnormalities, all of which contribute to the risk for preterm delivery. This has been mentioned previously, so I won't dwell on it, but it certainly, again, highlights the particular risk faced by non-Hispanic Black women and raises one of the interesting factors that we've seen related to women of Hispanic origin, where there seems to be a bit of a paradox, and one is also now seeing it when, if you look closely at Black women as well, the issue of acculturation. Women who've emigrated to the U.S. recently, in many groups, seem to have a protective effect in terms of the societal and community supports, maybe underlying health, that really seem to reduce their risk for preterm birth. Yet as they stay in the U.S. And over time, we see that effect vanishing. And what it's done is actually confused a lot of studies, because where there was this evidence of this in earlier studies, now in studies that are being published, many authors are saying, well, we're no longer seeing this effect, and it really may, in fact, be not so much a paradox within Hispanic communities, but the fact that you're seeing the effects of acculturation and environment really now supervening and taking, having a greater impact. Just briefly, in terms of infant mortality rate for preterm versus full-term infants, looking at some data from both the U.S. and Canada, we see that in particular issues related to short gestation and low birth weight, as well as infections in the perinatal period, are really the two factors that are most important in terms of the risk for preterm death. And over time, in the post-neonatal period, issues related to sudden infant death syndrome and injury-related death are important factors. This really just illustrates in the highlighted area, again, the importance of race and ethnicity, and one can see that for Puerto Rican women, although their rates are lower than that reported for Black women, they certainly are in excess of what's reported for other Latina women when one looks and compares against Mexican women, Cuban women, women from Central and South America. You also see on the right-hand panel the impact of multiple gestation in terms of both the contribution to preterm birth as well as the contribution to infant mortality. Race and ethnicity impact, again, not just neonatal mortality, meaning death within the first 27 days of life, but the postneonatal from day 28 through day 365. We see it most prevalent among non-Hispanic Black women, again, women of Puerto Rican descent, and American Indian and Alaskan Native women. This just illustrates the point I made before in terms of mothers who are foreign-born, although that you still do see risks related to race and ethnicity, there is a protective factor when one looks across the continuum, except for those women of Puerto Rican descent. And the impact, again, of race and ethnicity in terms of the contribution to preterm infant mortality. The next two slides really just illustrate a point in terms of not just, we always talk about the availability and access to care, and certainly those are critical, but one of the important factors as well is the quality of care that's actually being delivered to those women who are able to access care. And one of the interesting things that was recently noted in a publication put out by the National Center for Health Statistics is that infants born to Hispanic mothers tend to have lower rates of receipt of antenatal corticosteroids, which is a very important prenatal intervention to mature the lung function of preterm infants and reduce the risk for respiratory distress syndrome and complications related to the underlying lung immaturity, and also in the use of postnatal surfactant use. Again, surfactant replacing the endogenous protein and lipid that actually help stabilize lung function and assist babies with being able to breathe out of the uterus. So that suggests that there are certainly quality of care issues related to this as well, and this just shows the same thing in terms of receipt of admission to the neonatal intensive care unit. There really is not time to really review this, but this just shows you some of the health conditions that we see in terms of taking care of infants who are born preterm, both in terms of during their neonatal intensive care experience and those conditions that result in chronic sequela. When we look at neurodevelopmental outcomes, we see issues related to, among survivors, cerebral palsy, issues with low IQ, with IQs under 70, and neurodevelopmental impairment, really affecting a very significant portion of infants born younger than 32 weeks gestation. The most important factors that we see within the neonatal period relate to poor weight gain, issues related to perinatal brain injury, and chronic lung disease. And one can see that there's a dramatic interplay between, again, some of the underlying biologic factors as well as the various neonatal interventions and the post-discharge care of the infants, both in terms of the post-discharge environment, the healthcare needs, and the various comorbidities. This is one way that one can sort of look at, again, the interplay of those factors and potential outcomes for infants and realize that this is a continuum of care. It's not just through getting the baby to term equivalent, but it really is lifelong. And the impact of prematurity, both for the individual child, the family, as well as the community, is truly lifelong. In terms of environmental factors, we know that there's an interplay, again, of the social, ethnic, and educational background of the parents that influences the prevalence of disabilities. The Kauai longitudinal study really just followed a population of children in the 1950s who were born to poor families and compared them with against children whose families had more resources and really showed the dramatic difference in outcomes and the impact of poverty. And lack of parental education. Preterm infants, therefore, are at risk in terms of a double jeopardy, both in terms of the underlying biologic risks as well as the environmental risks, which certainly are synergistic on later functioning, although we do know that for the smallest, sickest babies, there does seem to be a ceiling effect where for some of these kids, the biology trumps the environment, although for the vast majority, environment is really the most important factor in terms of compensating for some of the earlier risks. In terms of again, looking at the range of issues, we know in terms of poverty, low socioeconomic status, all of these factors, availability and access of services, transiency, multiple competing health imperatives, as well as quality of schools, influence outcomes. But as I mentioned, that these can be moderated by the environment. And in terms of factors that mitigate some of the cognitive outcomes, maternal education is certainly an important one. We know that in terms of the relative risk, those mothers who've had less education, in fact, their children across the board, whether normal birth weight or very low birth weight, do have higher risks of needing special education. One important factor that I will just mention briefly is the importance of breast milk, and this is a low-tech intervention that we can do in terms of improving outcomes. And from a series of studies that have been published through the NICHD, the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development, looking at the population of babies that are enrolled in their studies, it's been shown that for each 10 cc's per kilo per day of breast milk that a preterm infant receives, you gain back a half an IQ point. So if a baby is fully breast milk fed, human milk fed, during their time in the neonatal ICU, you can make back 5 to 7 IQ points. And why is this important? Because the cost of being born preterm is about 10 to 12 IQ points. And so that this is a very low-tech intervention that has very high yield. And it's important within the context of this discussion because minority women are much less likely to breastfeed, provide breast milk for their babies, and exclusively breastfeed. There really isn't time to go through the rest of this, but certainly the cost of preterm birth is not just, again, to the families, but a big cost to society in terms of the cost for early intervention services, which we know now are not being supported. Despite there being a federal mandate, families increasingly have to provide pay for these services. And this was just to quickly show that the sort of, again, the disparate impact in terms of Hispanic and African American infants, both in terms of the quality of their overall health and continuing health issues, their need for services, and the impact in terms of cost for services. Just to finish up, that there certainly are multiple things, again, environment and family do make a big difference, and supports can be put in place that will improve outcomes over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Let me invite our speakers to come up here to the panel, and we're open for questions and comments. I'll ask you, if you would, please to introduce yourself and to let us know to whom your question is addressed. We'll start here.
A question to the entire panel. When you present data showing that the rates of preterm delivery are half in Western Europe, then we're not addressing the context of our society in which these conditions occur. And I would suggest that, you know, it's sort of like, here we are, we live in a society where we die younger than people in all the Western European countries, and we're unaware of the context of these things that might affect. I would suggest if we live in a society where everybody's smoking, lung cancer, so everybody's hoping to address that particular issue. And the issue I would suggest that we're not addressing are the contextual factors such that the Western European countries do, and I might offer one of them. Every Western European country offers paid prenatal leave. We don't offer paid parental leave either, but if you want to really stress, that's the time to do it, is one way to do it. So can we address these contextual?
Anyone want to pick up an answer to that question other than it would be a good idea?
Actually, unfortunately, in the slides that I didn't get to, and it was issues of child care and parental leave as some of the recommendations to improve those outcomes.
Other comments? Deborah?
I think that within that framework, though, and certainly you have issues in terms of access to care and the dramatic differences in terms of how care is provided and how health is viewed in other parts of the world in comparison to the U.S. You also, though, do have differences in the approach to the birth and care of babies born prematurely. In many of these countries as well, you don't have interventions initiated at 22, 23, even 24 weeks. It's the US and Japan that are competing to see how many 22-weekers you can keep alive, irrespective of the fact that you have 100% morbidity at the time of discharge and long-term disability.
Let's have a few other comments. We'll come back if we have the time. For the answers, you?
Yes.
All right, this is a rather low-tech room here. So other comments or questions? Yes, would you identify yourself, please?
And they're still coming to work with their laptops and everything. I don't think that's natural. So it would be situation. I've been maybe like 4 weeks or 2 weeks, I'm coming back to work. And that's part of it, being stressed to the very last minute of having that baby. People are maybe 24 hours after leaving work, and that can be normal.
Well, it may well not be natural, but it's normative, as you're pointing out in this country. And I'll ask, would you like Michelle to?
Well, I mean, I think these are all good points, and these are structural issues that we would have to address. I don't think anyone would dispute that. You know, we live in a society where people are scheduling deliveries because they know they have X number of days and weeks postpartum. And so it's the reality. How do we change that? I think we have to bring the evidence to the policy, and then we have to advocate, and then we have to promote these kinds of structural change. As Alan said, the description that you described, that's normative in the United States. And we all know that. We have colleagues who deliver and are rushing to deliver on their due date so that they can use their time to recover and get back to work.
Sure. And of course, in this country, preconception and interconception care is a new concept, which will hopefully be paid for as we move forward. But you know, you had to be pregnant to be able to get health insurance in this country. Which is clearly not a life course perspective or a reasonable or natural approach to trying to deal with the problems. So each of the incremental gains that we have, and we have had some in this last 2 years, whether or not the public's aware of them, we need to protect and preserve and then move from there to others. Yes.
Well, women care and healthy mommies have healthy babies, and I think with a sufficient Title X plan that we once saw yesteryear, many of you remember those yesteryears, there were a lot of the same wonderful programs that we hear about in the preconceptual and interconceptual, peer counseling, engaging high school students to help spread and educate. I think, you know, we have to, now I'm surprised that it's not the feminist issue of this millennium in trying to put mothering back in, you know, mothering and fathering and allowing women who want to have careers to applaud their mothering and fathering. And also, and I've done a lot of GIS work with Travel Network, travel analysts from GIS, and for those moms in socioeconomically disadvantaged populations, it's normative to have a preterm birth, but it's also But saddens me most, it seems normative for them to expect to take a bus with babies in tow, including fragile, medically fragile babies, to even prenatal care may not just be one visit. It may be, you know, multiple bus tokens and multiple physical facilities. So I think we really need to look, bring those upstream factors downstream to make it a feminist issue.
Your points are well taken. Anyone want to pick up on that? Okay. Would you introduce yourself, please? Yes. Yes, this young lady there.
I'm Lori Garitano. I'm faculty at LSU at Science Center in New Orleans. And Louisiana is one of the states with the highest preterm birth. And my question to the panel is, how do we change the model of prenatal care? The other issue is midwifery attendance for low risk women and the severe pregnancy that she mentioned. The merchandise in Louisiana that is great effort to try to bring severe pregnancy to the model of care. I can't find a site in New Orleans right now. So I'm trying to do research and compare different models. And I just wonder, all these women are the highest risk are being paid by Medicaid for their care. So how much longer do you think, or how do you think we're going to tunnel that, the funds, the limited funds we have, to better models of prenatal care that will make a difference?
Diane?
I
I wish I had an answer for you, actually. No, I agree with you, but I guess the implementation of many of these group prenatal care services are dependent on the physical structures within health facilities, on the available resources. There are expenses associated with training, there are expenses associated with certification, and I guess those are all factors that need to be taken into account. But certainly acknowledging that there are other models of providing prenatal care and by other providers other than physicians that can be very effective and provide more resources and more time with individual patients and health education.
The March of Dimes has invested several millions of dollars in increasing centering pregnancy programs around the country and will place another million into new programs in 2011. But it clearly is still a burgeoning process. We've had champions around the country supporting it, both physicians and non-physicians. I think that's a very local issue, as you're correct. But I think that we're seeing very different outcomes in those programs, and that I think is really going to drive as we get the evidence to show the outcomes. Even doctors are educable most of the time. Would you please identify yourself? Your points are well taken. In a recent Obstetrics and Gynecology article in October of 2010, it showed that 43% of women who plan a vaginal delivery will be induced prior to their initiating labor. 21% of those women will be sectioned because the induction is not actually working, which one could predict before you started that induction by doing what obstetricians have been doing for half a century, and that is evaluating the readiness of the cervix and uterus, and an additional 30% are not even being induced, they're going directly to cesarean section, which suggests that in America there is about 25% of women who are going into natural labor. These data are extraordinary. So focusing only on the cesarean section rate may not be the appropriate metric, but focusing on quality improvement to enhance decision-making around, as Professor Lederer is mentioning, around the question of decision-making about who gets induced, who gets sectioned, and then the NICHD Vaginal Birth After Cesarean Consensus Conference, which was held this past year, again highlights the fact that women are not being given the opportunity to have a vaginal birth after cesarean, and that opportunity ought to be given to at least 60% of women who have had cesarean sections, if not 75%. And some programs, like the regional programs in New England, have actually allowed women to go to institutions that are A-willing and have doctors who are available. We're working with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who are trying to soften their guidelines toward enhancing vaginal births, but this is an extraordinary complex issue for the obstetric community and for the hospitals, with the serious problem of litigation, even when everything's done right, but the outcome for the baby is not as we would have wished it.
So, the increase in maternal mortality that's been with the high C-section rate. So, I mean, it's both the poor outcomes for the children and the mothers.
And you'll identify yourself?
Joanne Fisher from Maternity Care.
Thank you. Okay, other comments or questions? Yes, please, if you'd identify yourself. Okay. Perhaps we'll ask Claudia for the father and Michelle for the intention.
You know, there's no question that one of the most powerful variables in many interviews has been unintended pregnancy and delivering not a good outcome. The question is, how do you get your hands around what that means? What's incorporated in all of the features of unintended pregnancy? I think we should try, but it's pretty complicated. The father, oh, that's a tough one. I know in the study we did, 40 to 50% of moms weren't married and weren't living with the partner necessarily at the time of prenatal care. So it could be a very interesting thing to study. It's not an easy thing to study. And I don't know if other people working with sort of at-risk communities have some things they'd like to say about that.
Claire, I think it's interesting that you asked, that you put these two questions together. I spend a fair bit of the last 2 years studying intimate partner violence, and that is part of the contextual, structural, life reality for many women in this country and globally. And unintended pregnancies is often a result of sexual violence by an intimate partner. And so I think the unintended pregnancy issue has been long studied in the context of adverse outcomes in these unintended. We spent decades classifying and segregating unwanted, mistimed, and unintended. And we know that there are strong associations with adverse maternal and perinatal outcomes. The intimate partner violence piece is just developing in its role in increasing unintended pregnancies by two or threefold in different communities of women around the globe. The contribution of the father, in our populations that we study, like Claudia's, 30 to 40% of the fathers are not involved at all in the antepartum life of the pregnancies. So it's an important point, but hard to study when the absence of a partner. It can be. It's manifest as stress. It's manifested as an absent social network. Usually those studies are looking at more of the social network, not just the paternal contribution, but social support.
Yes. Would you identify yourself? Thank you. Yes, identify yourself.
I'm Isadora Hare. I'm from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, part of HRSA. And one of the things that struck me here was that in all our analysis of environmental factors, the political was really omitted. And I think that the political and economic factors that exist in this country can never really be ignored. And apropos of that, I just wanted to share with you that that the role of the father is becoming a politically hot issue in Washington. And there are a number of organizations that have been formed that are really advocating in this direction. And I think, I'm not an expert on the research, but I think there is some evidence that even men who are no longer involved with the pregnant woman and delivering woman, and therefore are kind of excluded from any postnatal care, actually, if approached and educated, would be willing to play a role in the life of the child. Now, obviously, we need studies about that, but I just repeat that I think at this point in time, it's kind of politically, it has some political power behind it, and so it's a propitious time to study that.
Well, I think we will draw to a close with that comment. If there are any last comments from our panelists?
Just one quick point. Mm-hmm. Your point about politics is well taken and embedded in the whole understanding of segregation and hyper-segregation. You have to think back to the formation of ghettos. Urban ghettos in the United States is a part of a construct that resulted from political activities. We're talking about massive migrations of poor Southern blacks to urban centers starting in the 70s, and we are living that legacy, and we're seeing that. So it's embedded in all of what we're doing.
Okay. Please join me in thanking our panelists, and thank you for your attention. The sign-in sheet is somewhere.